impressive because that was back when they taught law as opposed to law and public policy, whatever that is. He also has as a credential the fact that he clerked with the late Justice Byron White. After that, he went with Wilmer and Cutler in D.C. and then in London for 23 years. He doesn't quite have a British accent, but then again, he doesn't have a Southern accent either. We're just delighted to have him because he's an outstanding jurist. This is the fourth time he's sat with us, and we invite him back because he's what we affectionately refer to as a full load-bearing person, which means that he takes his share of the work and discharges it with distinction. So welcome.
Thank you, sir.
First case up, U.S. versus Waters. Gary Bunch, we'll hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
I've got the pleasure of representing Mr. Waters. There's an old saying in the law that how you go into a case often determines how you come out of the case. And here, the prosecution went into the case focused on the wrong issues, and because of that, the government failed to meet its burden of proof. The prosecutor focused solely on two items, the December 16th IRS letter, which was later determined to be a fake and false, and the amount of the loan that was sought. But the prosecutor failed to look at the terms of the loan rather than just the amount.
If the misrepresentation of the letter or letters doesn't matter, if it was no potential for harm, if there was no intent to harm, why did he do it?
Well,
whenever I hear "well," I understand that that means let me think. I can come up with something.
No, the point being is that it's irrelevant. It may be bad. It may be wrong. I didn't try the case, Your Honor.
But you've got to have a theory, or at least there has to be a theory for to work. If it didn't matter?
Well, he denied that he wrote the letter.
I understand, but he lost that. And assuming for purposes of our discussion, there was certainly evidence that he did. Assuming purposes of our discussion that he did, why tender that letter, forged letter, two letters, if they had no probative effect on the decision maker and wouldn't have furthered his desire to get the loan?
It would have induced the decision maker to make the loan. But there's a difference. You can induce someone into a transaction, but if the deception is not intended to harm, and if the deception is not part of the bargain, the fact that you deceive someone is not sufficient for wire fraud under the wire fraud statute of 28.1342. Now, under the bank fraud statute, it would be. But this was not a federally regulated bank, and it didn't come under the bank statute, saying they didn't prosecute under the bank statute. So we've got to look at two things. You've got to divide up. On one hand, is there deception? I had an economics teacher who was a brilliant man in college, but he was not real articulate all the time, and he had every class he would pause to get his next thought, and he'd have a filler, and the filler was always necessary but not sufficient. And I didn't understand as a young man what necessary but not sufficient really meant, but this is a classic case of it. Deception is necessary for fraud, but it's not sufficient for fraud. You can have deception without fraud.
Sir, didn't the deception go to the creditworthiness of the borrower?
No, because...
Why not?
Because Mr. Waters was not the borrower. If you look at the term sheet, and that was
his deception was directed to Colony, which was considering making the loan.
But they were not making the loan.
And Colony, a lender ordinarily wouldn't be pleased to engage in a transaction with someone who wasn't trustworthy.
But, Your Honor, Mr. Waters was not the borrower. If you look through the transcript, the prosecution, the government, used the words very imprecisely in this case. If you look at the term sheet, the borrower was the LLC, and the borrower was
wholly owned by Mr. Waters and his wife.
The LLC was
so owned. He was standing behind the. I realize there wasn't a veil piercing argument here, but he was standing behind the corporations.
But if you look at the term sheet, I'm not arguing with you, Honor. I'm just trying to point out the term sheet. The first two items in the term sheet. If you look at the docket 54, it was Exhibit 11 at the trial. The term sheet specifies who the borrower was, and the borrower was going to be an LLC.
Well, I appreciate that, but the LLC wasn't a human being who was standing there trying to convince Colony to enter into this transaction. Right, Mr. Waters was acting on behalf of the LLC for clearly in order to try to cause the Colony to advance this money.
That you can advance, nothing's wrong with trying to advance somebody the money. The question is.
But isn't the short answer, we know it's important to the lender because the lender indicated so. When they realized he had tax liens, they indicated they'd like to see if there was going to be a tax payment because the flow of payments back could be greatly affected by the individuals behind the transactions. There's no question he knew this was not going to happen unless he showed to them some payment schedule of the IRS. Don't we know for sure that was important to the lender?
No, ma'am. With all due respect, Judge Carnes, it's not because...
They asked for it. They weren't going to give the loan without it. What more do you need?
But that was the inducement part. Yes, because the issue becomes that if you look at the transcript, they say that the lien brought up an issue was he being honest. Was he acting with integrity? If you have an undisclosed lien, they were focused on the undisclosed nature because they were willing. All through the transcript, it's saying that they were willing to pay off the lien. They would go forward with the loan if the lien was taken care of either by being paid off.
I thought Baker, the lawyer for Colony, testified that it was material, that it did matter. And I thought Sanchez testified to the jury that those liens, the existence of the liens and failure to disclose them was a deal killer. His term.
He had to separate the two out. He did say that the liens, the failure to the fake letter is what he said was a deal closer. Chance says if you look at this testimony on 274, when we found out the letter was fake, we immediately stopped. On 241, he says, the question was, why did Colony not move forward with the loan? We learned that the letter had been fabricated. After you learned that the letter was fabricated, was there any chance that you would still loan Waters the money? Absolutely not. So you have to distinguish between the integrity issue. It's kind of like the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Something can be profitable, but it's illegal if you have to pay, a $100,000 bribe, and you get a $10 million contract. The shareholders back here in America are profiting, but the government and society does not want to have corporations engage in stuff that lack integrity. Or lenders are the same way. So here you distinguish. It was not the lien which was material. It was the misrepresentation that was what was mysterious, the fake letter that was what was material. Because the lender had said that they would go forward with the loan if the lien was resolved either through a payment plan.
Right, but once they learned that your client's attempt to procure a settlement with the IRS was fraudulent, the pencil's down was what the guy said. I think those were his words, meaning we'll have no more to do with this, so that the deception was material to the lender.
Well, there's a difference down between pencil down and what Chance says. The lawyer says it's pencil down because he's trying to figure out how to pay the lien, and there's three options. He could have a payment plan, he could just pay it off if he found the money, or he could borrow it, and the broker was willing to borrow the money. So it was pencil down till they resolved the lien, but they was going to go forward with the loan. But what stopped the loan was not the pencils down, it was the fake ID, a letter. Once they learned that the letter was fake, That's what was stopping it. Pencils down was saying, yes, we're going to pause. We're going to solve this problem. It's a manageable problem. We either have to get a payment plan approved by the IRS. We have to get Just Phil, the broker, to make him a loan, or we'll make him a loan at you know, big interest rates, or he can come up with the money. So the lien was an issue that caused the pencils to go down. You're correct, Your Honor. But the lien was not what stopped him, because if they'd have stopped, don't forget the timetable. If they'd have stopped when they discovered the lien, they discovered the lien back.
Well, the jury obviously disagreed with you, right?
Well, no, this really wasn't presented to the jury like this. But the point being is, if you look at the timetable, don't forget that the lien was discovered before the fake letter was discovered, and they were continuing to negotiate. After the lien had discovered, they didn't stop negotiating. They stopped the due diligence on other aspects of the loan.
But is this you're trying to get a point that there's no harm here?
There's no harm here. There's absolutely no harm.
Well, what about the amount of money that Colony put into working up this loan and the airfare for the gentleman who flew back from California to inspect the property? That all went down the drain because of the deception.
Well, they had an advance fee. They had an advance fee. But there's no intent to harm, because here he was over-collateralized.
One thing that hurts your chances of success on this argument, apart from the pure merits of, or lack thereof, of the argument, is this is not a usual review for the sufficiency of the evidence. In fact, because you didn't renew the Rule 29 after the jury's verdict came in, we only review under our precedent for manifest miscarriage of justice, don't we?
I would refer you, Your Honor, I'm glad you brought that up, because I cited a case that you wrote an occurring opinion in, Fries versus United States. And Fries, if you recall, Fries was that's 725 Fed Third of 1286. It's cited on page 16 in our brief for manifest injustice. And I agree with your standard, Your Honor. And that case involved a prosecution under 28 U.S.C. 922A5. And that is... And the question presented to this court was whether the evidence was insufficient to convince, when no evidence was presented, as to whether the buyer of the farm was a licensed dealer. And Chief Judge Kearns, in that opinion, stated that the court reversed the opinion, saying there's no evidence, so it could be no conviction. And I think Fries may have been a manifest injustice case, but I'm not sure, so I don't want to misstate it. But what you said there shows why manifest injustice sets here. It says, Fries did not sucker punch the government. Instead, it knocked itself out of a valid conviction by not asking its witness a simple question, the importance of which is obvious from the indictment's allegation that Fries had transferred the farm to a person not being licensed importer, manufacturer, dealer, or collector of farms. It is not asking too much to expect a prosecutor before a trial is to look at the indictment to ensure that all the elements alleged in it have been proven. The prosecutor in this case failed to do so.
Two things. Number one, I'm not sure that was manifest miscarriage of justice standard. And number two, there's a difference between no evidence and some evidence.
But they never asked a single witness from the lender, the broker, anybody involved, what was the bargain? What was the bargain? They never asked the witness.
They didn't have to, because it was evident what the bargain was.
Right.
But we have your opening
and
argument.
And can I reverse the rest of my time?
All right. Ms. Malloy.
May it please the court, Bernita Malloy on behalf of the United States. I'd like to first focus on the intent to harm, the first issue, sufficiency of the evidence. Your Honors, there is more than sufficient evidence in the record to show that when the defendant lied to Colony about his tax liens and created a fake IRS letter, he lied about the nature of the bargain between himself and Colony. Therefore, those lies fall squarely within a scheme to defraud as defined by this court in United States versus Tagaloff. I'd like to address Tagaloff and the intent to harm, Your Honor.
Could you just tell me what the nature of the bargain was before you start?
Yes, Your Honor. As Colony defined the bargain, their willingness to lend a $6 million loan to the defendant if he was creditworthy. In exchange, the defendant would have to pay back the loan. And the evidence is clear from the record that the tax liens was something that directly impacted Colony's ability to assess his creditworthiness. Clearly, Your Honor, based on the testimony, Colony's attorney, Bo Baker, testified that when they discovered, he discovered during due diligence, over $450,000 of tax liens, that that was something that affected their ability to assess the creditworthiness.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the time goes by quickly. It seems to me that the nature of the bargain that you're arguing and the nature of the bargain your adversary's arguing are sort of getting slapped onto this case after the trial. I read the transcript, and I didn't see any testimony going to the jury about what was the essence of the bargain.
Your Honor, there wasn't.
So it looked to me like the Tech Kalinchoff case is sort of being loaded on to this case at the appellate level. Am I wrong?
Your Honor, no. In terms of, I was a trial prosecutor in that case.
It's sort of a disconnect for me because I don't understand. It looks to me like the way the case was tried to the jury, from Mr. Waters' point of view, was, well, there wasn't any real deception with regard to the financial disclosure, and I didn't do it. I didn't make the letters. And I didn't hear the government coming in and saying, well, the nature of the bargain here was making loan on a creditworthy basis and yada, yada.
With all due respect, Your Honor, it's the government's position that this case was not about lies that went to deception. This case was about lies that went to the very heart of the riskiness of the loan, the very nature of the bargain. In fact, the evidence establishes, Your Honor, that when Colony discovered the tax liens, they then said to defendant's attorney, this is a deal breaker. The tax liens either have to be discharged or payment plan had to be in place.
When the Colony official said pencils down, was that pencils down, it were finished, or pencils down, will continue to work?
The testimony was they went pencils down because when they could not get the tax liens resolved, they stopped working on the loan completely.
So you're saying the jury could have found that Colony said, unless you clear up these liens, there's no loan because that goes to the nature and the heart of the bargain, your creditworthiness. And they couldn't or didn't get them cleared up, as opposed to you've lied to us, fool me once, et cetera, and we don't want to do business with you, right?
Correct, Your Honor. As this court has defined harm in Tagaloff on page 1313 as obtaining by deceptive means something to which the defendant is not entitled to. Your Honor, here the harm to Colony is that they intended to loan the defendant a $6 million loan that he wasn't entitled to.
Well, isn't under that case, the lead case you're talking about, harm is presumed if the deceit went to the nature of the bargain?
Yes.
I mean, it's almost as if you're not looking for any other harm. If you first identify what is the essence of the bargain, and then you ask, did the deception go to that? And if the answer is yes, the deception went to that, then there has been sufficient harm.
Yes. And this court...
Is that a correct reading of the lead case?
In Tagaloff, Your Honor, I think this court does an excellent job in breaking down. First of all, it defines the difference between deceiving and defrauding. And then in Tagaloff, it talks about and describes that a scheme to defraud, as used in the wire fraud statute, refers to only those schemes that include an intent to harm. And when defining harm, this court said, is obtaining by deceptive means something to which the defendant is not entitled to. But as part of Tagaloff, this court used the nature of the bargain or value of the bargain 11 times in Tagaloff's opinion. One time on page 1313, 8 times on page 1314, and 2 times on page 1316, showing the importance of nature of the bargain in analyzing intent to harm. This court.
Well, the opinion also relies heavily on Second Circuit cases that go back a long time, and all those cases say the same thing.
Say the same thing in terms
say
of.
Say the same thing as what you're saying is that this court adopted when it also adopted, in essence, the rationale of a long line of cases out of the Second Circuit.
That's correct, Your Honor. Absolutely. And it's the government's position that the defendant's argument that the government didn't prove intent to harm, therefore this case should be reversed under Tagaloff, fails for three reasons.
Let me ask you this. If the whole case goes down on the question of whether or not the deceit goes to the nature of the bargain, then shouldn't a jury be charged on that basis?
I would like to address that issue, Your Honor. With respect to the issue of abuse of discretion, whether the district court abuses discretion in refusing to give defendant's version of a Tagaloff instruction. First of all, it's the government's position that the defendant's requested version of the Tagaloff charge was incomplete and therefore an inaccurate statement of the law. And why is that?
That's his instruction number 9 we're talking about?
That's correct, Your Honor. And why is it an incomplete, inaccurate statement of the law?
Is that the extent of his complaint? Because he in his charge, he also asked for 2 additions to the pattern charges, one based on Hassan and one based on another case. And is that on Bradley? Do you understand that to be part of the challenge here, that those other 2 pieces weren't given?
I don't, Your Honor. I understand his challenge to be
just to chart to number 9.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And with respect to that, for there to be an abuse of discretion, this court needs to find all 3 elements. First, the requested charge was a correct statement of the law. Second, the subject matter was not substantially covered by the other instruction. And third, that the subject matter dealt with an issue at trial that was so important that the failure to include it seriously impaired defendant's ability to defend himself. Here, defendant cannot satisfy the first prong. His version of the Tagaloff requested charge was incomplete and an inaccurate statement of the law. He correctly cites some sentencings from Tagaloff that talks about the difference between defrauding and deceiving and the need for an intent to harm. But what's missing, Your Honors, is he completely omits the court's ultimate holding in Tagaloff that talks about the nature of the bargain, and that this court held that the nature of the bargain is important to talk about a scheme to defraud and intent to harm.
So your bottom line view is that the charge number 9 that he proposed, which is half of Tagaloff but not the second half about the nature of the bargain, would actually be misleading.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And with respect, Your Honor, to the
what do I do, if anything, with the fact that when you added your piece to the Tagaloff charge, saying if you're going to give it, this is what you would be fine with, and then the court, in essence, offered to give that charge.
Your Honor, what happened at the charge conference is initially the government argued that
He said, I'm not inclined to give it, but if I did give it, I would add the government's instruction. How do you feel about that, Mr. Kish? And Mr. Kish said, in essence, he didn't want that.
Correct. And the government initially in the charge conference, Your Honor.
So what I was trying to get at is that you're not arguing that he's really a stop from making his challenge to the whole charge issue because he waived it by not accepting the charge as amended. You're not making that argument, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
With respect to the second element, defendant also failed, that element fails because it's the government's position that the requested charge was covered by the charge that was given. And I'd like to walk through that with the court.
Well, on that point, the Tagaloff case said that the pattern charge that was offered in that case was the Tagaloff charge was not covered by that.
And that's
a part of the holding in that case, because part of the problem was that the same disjunctive pattern charge that Mr. Waters objects to here was given in that case. And the court, in analyzing whether or not that charge was sufficient under the 4-part test, concluded that the charge that was being requested was not covered.
And that's correct, but our case is different from the facts in Tagaloff. Unlike in Tagaloff, the defendant's theory
that,
of defense
governs whether or not the the Tachikoff charge is covered by the pattern charge?
No. The government's position, Your Honor, that the facts in Tagaloff supported that the failure for the district court judge to give the Tagaloff requested charge is different than the facts here. Here, Your Honor, the government's position is that we believe that the charge that defendant requested, the Tagaloff charge that he requested, was substantially covered by the charges that were given.
How so?
I'm going to walk the court through it.
Thank you.
Point number one, defendant asked for it. Deceiving does not always constitute defraud. That can be found at document 45-12. This was substantially covered in the instruction when the court gave the instruction that said, not all misrepresentations or omissions constitute a scheme to defraud. That could be found at docket 89-619. Point number two, defendant requested there must be an intent to harm for deceiving to constitute defrauding. This was covered substantially by the instruction given when the court gave the instruction that read, a statement or representation is false or fraudulent if it is about a material fact that the speaker knows is untrue and makes with the intent to defraud. Number three, intent to harm is a request to obtain by deceptive means something to which the defendant is not entitled to. Defendant requested that again at document 45-12. This was also substantially covered with the instruction given by Judge Batten that said a scheme to defraud includes any plan or course of action intended to deceive or cheat somebody out of money or property. When viewed as a whole, it's the government's position that the subject matter of the defendant's requested Tagaloff charge was substantially covered by the judge's instruction that was given. And finally, the third element can't be satisfied for abuse of discretion. The lack of intent to harm was not defendant's theory of defense at trial. Defendants only entitled to a theory of defense is limited to what evidence was presented at trial. Here in trial, defendant's theory was the letter was fake, but you got the wrong person. It wasn't me. Additionally, he argued that the letter wasn't material to Colony. Defendant presented no evidence whatsoever, Your Honor, about the lack of intent to harm. Therefore, the district court's refusal to give his version of the Tagaloff instruction could not have possibly impaired his ability to present an effective defense. And even if this court disagrees with respect to abuse of discretion as to prongs 1, 2, or 3, and the government is not conceding that the district court abuses discretion.
When he says, I didn't do it, that's showing that he had no intent to harm, isn't it?
Beg your pardon?
When he says, I didn't do it, I mean, can't the jury infer that he didn't have any intent to harm if he didn't actually do it?
No, Your Honor, because I believe under Tagaloff, intent to harm is defined obtaining by deceptive means something to which you are not entitled to. And even if the court finds that prongs 1, 2, and 3 are not satisfied,
he wasn't entitled to a loan if he was uncreditworthy. That's your bottom line?
Correct. He lied about the nature of the bargain, and he impaired and circumvented Colony's ability to accurately assess his creditworthiness, Your Honor.
Of course, his position is, I was entitled to a loan because the collateral I put up exceeded substantially the amount of the loan.
And, Your Honor, that's irrelevant. It doesn't matter, because as this court defined harm in Tagaloff.
No, you just said a loan to which he was not entitled. I assume that by entitled you don't mean that they had an obligation to give it to him, but that they wouldn't have given it to him otherwise.
Correct, Your
Honor. But his position is, of course they would have. I had collateral that exceeded the value of the loan by 25% to 50%, and any lender would have done that.
But, Your Honor, that's not relevant for the determination because, as this court said in United States versus Maxwell, financial loss is not at the core of the mail and wire fraud cases.
Well, then your statement that he was not entitled to the loan misses the mark. By entitled to the loan, what do you mean?
What I mean, Your Honor, is that when he lied about the nature, I see that my time is up.
Yes, please.
When he lied about the nature of the bargain, about his creditworthiness, he lied and he impaired Colony's ability to assess his creditworthiness, Your Honor.
That doesn't mean he wasn't entitled to the loan. What do you mean by the word entitled?
In Tagalog, the court says entitled meaning that you're not allowed to get something that you're not rightfully deserved when you lie about it. He lied about the nature of the bargain. So he impaired Colony's ability. Maybe I'm not understanding the court.
We're not connecting on that question, but your time is up, so we'll hear from Mr. Bunch. So 5 minutes in reply.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I think you hit the nail on the head with a couple of piercing questions. The prosecution at trial said Tagalog law did not apply. They didn't try the case viewing the prongs and the requirements of Tagalog law. They told Judge Batten that it didn't apply. Now they come in this court and say it applies, but they think it's dispositive the other way. And what they've done is deprive Mr. Waters of a Seventh Amendment right to a trial by jury. They're asking this court to, after the fact, go back and do revisionist history to recreate the facts to support their conviction. At the very least, Your Honors, he was entitled to the Tagalog charge. And we don't forget that the law on jury charges, do you have enough evidence in the record, is a very low bar. We cite the cases in our brief. You're all aware of them. The defendant, and they're trying to flip the burden of proof to the defendant. They try the case.
It seems to me like your position would have this court holding that someone who's entering into a contract can lie all they want to, so long as the heart of the bargain is different from what the lies are aimed at. But the problem with the heart of the bargain, that sounds like such a precise term, it's not really that precise. And Judge Thapar, in his opinion, in Tagalog, used as something that wasn't going to the heart of the bargain the deceit that the defendant was the long-lost cousin of the other contracting party. But there's a lot of difference between a lie about long-lost cousin and a lie about federal tax liens on the property of a borrower. That's the problem for your argument.
I understand, and you got a very good point there, but if you look at the term sheet, which is the government's Exhibit 11, which is in our under Docket 54, it was totally structured. They had collateral, they had cash management that totally protected them. It's not just the collateral here, Your Honor. It's the cash management. Plus,
I think your problem, sir, is that most lenders don't like to do business with dishonest people, even if the numbers work out.
I agree with that 100%.
If a bailout lender like the Colony, if a word got around that it was delighted to make loans to people that deceived it, it would be inundated with these kind of loans, right?
The
reputation has to have some factoring in financial transactions. Well, if you went to a bank and told them, walked in and said, I want you to know I'm a liar and a deceitful person, but please loan me some money, it's all collateralized. You think the bank would loan it to you?
I think some banks would. If you look at
I
think if you look at Exhibit 11, they had an escrow account. They was only lending out $4,150,000. They was putting another $1,085,000 in an escrow reserve account. They had cash management, which gave them total control over the receipts, and their own brokers and their own analysis said that the projected rent was sufficient to cover the cash flow. So they were in a position to make money, but yes, they didn't own a deal with integrity. But the more important point, and what's critical of this case, is who makes that decision? Does the judges make it, the Court of Appeals make it, or does the jury make it? Now, the jury may have not accepted Mr. Waters' arguments, but he had a right to have them presented to the jury and to have a proper charge so that the jury could understand his arguments, his position, and counterbalance it in the context of this situation and judge people's credibility in that situation. And they cut off. The court, they're recreating the facts here. It's post hoc. At the court, they told Judge Batten that Tocolo didn't apply. And Judge Batten says, well, it's very confusing. Well, that's the whole part of Tocolo's charge, is to delineate out deception without harm, which doesn't constitute fraud, and deception that is coupled with harm that constitutes fraud.
But the judge at one point said the government had offered, well, we'll go along with your charge, but we want to complete it. We don't want the incomplete charge that the defense counsel's asking. We want to add other things. Judge Batten says to defense counsel, well, okay, is that okay with you? And the defense counsel doesn't say, yay, yeah, let's go for that. He says, not sure, Judge, hadn't thought about it, which is equivalent of, no, I don't want to proceed forward with this request.
Well, I have two responses to that, Your Honor. One is that the Mr. Waters' counsel gave an accurate statement of Tocolo as far as he went.
Yeah, totally accurate. He stopped.
But the concept of fraud, the distinction between deception and by itself,
counsel,
is not being
insufficient. I thought the question was, isn't that what happened? Isn't that what was transpired when the judge made that statement and defense counsel responded?
I agree that Judge Carnes...
That's answer number one. Briefly and concisely, what's your second point in answer to that question?
The point is that two things. One,
you've used up the first one. What's the second point? I've allowed you to go over both times, but we've got to bring this argument to a conclusion.
The point is, Your Honor, that the requested charge as it was requested was not misleading. When you ask for completeness, you only have to have completeness if the requested charge is misleading without what you want to put in there.
Thank you, counsel. We've got your case. Take that case under submission. Next up is U.S. versus Lewis. We start on the page from the left and right.
Why do they do that?
We didn't do it in state court. Yeah, we did not do it in state court. And it trips me up. All right, so. Ms. Lund, we're ready when you are.